with you north to be south to south to be north where I'm from, Virginia. Of course, south to be north to be south. What it's like? Hey yo, it is what it is. Yeah. Hey yo, what it is? Hey yo, what it is? What it is? It couldn't be nothing else.
Hi, is this Tony Griffin?
Yep.
Hey man, it's Andy.
Andy, what's happening?
Nothing much. I see that you have an 818 number. Does that mean that you're here in Los Angeles?
I am. I'm in. I live in Hollywood.
That's awesome. So do I, man.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So speaking of the whole, I'm out here in Los Angeles. You're out here in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Both spend time in Reston.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about where you come from originally?
Mm-hmm.
Were you born in the Northern Virginia area, or did you come there later?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you from, man?
Well, if you want to take it right from the beginning, I was born in Ottawa, Canada. So Ottawa is the capital of Canada, if you may or may not know that. When I was about 1 year old, we moved to Germantown, Maryland.
Okay.
And then we lived there for a couple of years because my dad got a job in the satellite business. And then briefly after that, he got a job at ESA, which is the European Space Agency, in Holland. So then we moved to Holland, and then we lived in Holland for about 4 years in a town called Lisse, which is near The Hague, like Den Haag. And then after that, we moved to Germany, and I lived in Germany till I was about 14, and that's when we moved to Reston after that, because my dad then got a job working on the space station program, which was based in just outside of Reston, right? Or in Reston, actually, right? That's the long version of how I got to Reston.
What was it like when you first arrived there as a teenager after having lived abroad for so long?
Oh man, it was such a culture shock, man. It was insane. I mean, everything was different. I mean, not just the language, because I was actually going to German school, and the only English I was speaking, I was speaking English with like a British accent, actually, because I was like, because for a while I was going to, in the early days, I was going to like the British School of the Netherlands. So I was speaking, all my friends were English, British English, I should say. So that was already weird, you know, just the slang and the language already. But then on top of it, the school system was completely different. I was so lost. I was walking around South Lake, like, where am I? What's going on? I don't know what these people are talking about. Who are they, you know? Who's that? I mean, it was like I was on a different planet, you know? I mean, just culturally, it was completely different from Germany, you know, totally different. So, but I mean, in Germany is when I was, you know, it's when I started getting into like metal and thrash metal in particular. So when I arrived in Reston, I was so hungry for just, you know, because most of the music, the bands I was listening to were American. I was like, you know, I was already thinking, God, I can't wait to get to DC because I'm going to be like immersed in like, I'm going to get to the source of all my favorite music, you know? And so right away I was like seeking out, you know, the punk rock kids at high school and the metalheads, and you know, and luckily there was actually a pretty cool little punk, you know, like a hardcore scene at South Lake, you know. And you know, pretty quickly, and that's how, and that's you know, I got my nickname Spooky at South Lake, you know, because I had like the long hair, and you know, Metallica Slayer T-shirts, and I think so. What happened is people were like, "Oh, that guy, he looks evil," or something, and then when I started talking to them, they realized I wasn't like. Actually, kind of like that. I was like a friendly kind of evil, so that's where the spooky nickname came from. So, but yeah, I mean, it was like, and then you know what I was kind of surprised about? Like, even though there was a cool scene in DC, you know, in terms of like underground metal and punk and all that, and the hardcore scene. Coming from Germany, I thought it was going to be, like, this huge scene. You know, I thought it was going to be, like, everyone would know about all these, you know, underground bands. But the truth is, like, in Germany, people actually know much more about, thrash metal. And it's, they know more about it than people in the U.S. itself. Do you see what I'm saying? Because... It's kind of like in Europe, they're so hungry for wanting to know what's going on in the music scene in the U.S. that if you buy like a heavy metal magazine, they're talking about super underground bands, and they show footage of like, you know, DRI or pictures, photo shoots of like all these. And we're thinking, and in Germany, we're thinking, God, this is like, you know, slam dancing and, you know, stage diving. This is insane, you know. And so when you go to a concert in Germany, the people are like, it's like tenfold people, you know, tenfold as many people are doing it in the U.S. in terms of like copying the U.S. style of like, you know, skate punk or, you know, all that like hardcore and all that shit. So it was a lot more underground than I expected it to be when I arrived in the U.S. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, so what was the scene?
Well, the scene was, back then, it was like, the scene was basically, you know, well, I mean, in terms of, like, South Lake High School, there was, like, you mean South Lake High School or D.C.? Or like?
I mean, both.
Right. Well, I mean, D.C., the scene in D.C. was basically this club called D.C. Space, which is, like, a very small venue. That maybe you could fit like, I don't know, maybe like 80 people in there or 70 people in there. And then there was 930 Club. Those were the main two kind of actual clubs. And then there was also, once in a while, there was, they would do kind of like a metal matinee on Saturdays at like 2 p.m. At this place called the Hung Jury Pub. And I used to go to that, where I saw bands such as Rancid from Maryland, Iron Christ, Indestroy. Local bands in Reston, there was Hostile Environment, which I'm sure you must have talked about at some point. kind of like another offshoot of hospital environment called Remission. That's
right.
Another band, which I feel like, I'm not sure if he was in that band too. So that's hospital environment. Then there was LDK. They were kind of the biggest band. LDK was the biggest band on campus, basically. Generation, whatever you want to call it. I'm pretty sure Transcendence is the first group to like make a demo cassette, and I think that was kind of a big deal because after we put out a cassette, then all these other bands started talking, like, you know, following us basically, and that really, once people started making cassettes, then it was all of a sudden like, oh wait a minute, these are all potential, like, huge, these are suddenly real bands. They're just in high school, but they've got a cassette. And so cassette is like, wait a minute, then it's like, from the cassette, you know, we were able to get gigs, like, you know, in high school we were opening up for Biohazard, Corrosion of Conformity, Econo Christ, and, you know, and I think That was kind of an eye opener for all these other bands, like, even bands in from Herndon High, they were suddenly it's like that. They were all starting to make, you know, demo cassettes basically. And I think I'm pretty sure Transylvania was the first band out of that scene to make a cassette, and it was a huge initiator, you know what I'm saying? Like kick everyone in the ass, basically. You know, like put fire into people's ass a bit. You know, to actually like really not just, you know, just kind of push it up a level. You know what I mean?
Yeah, not just play in somebody's basement or garage.
Exactly. But like, actually, y'all, like, and to be honest, the demo cassette thing, I learned, I actually learned that from being in Germany, because when I was as a metal fan in Germany, we would order, like, I would, you know, do mail cassette order, like, you know, early demos from, like, Metallica, Slayer bootleg cassettes and all that stuff, and, like, demo cassettes, like, there's this one metal band called Legacy from, I guess they're from San Bay area, It's like this demo was like a classic. It's like better than their debut album. Demo cassette, back in those days, that's really how you got a record deal. You had to have a demo. You know, if you don't have a demo, you don't get a record deal. And we actually got a bunch of record deal offers, you know, from Enigma Records, from this demo cassette. But we didn't really, we were too young to know how to deal with it. We had this one manager came at us out of nowhere from like Minneapolis, and he was wanted to sign us, and we actually got real major label record deals offers, but we didn't. We were too young to. And sometimes I think, wow, what would have happened if TransLinear signed like a major label deal when we were like 17 or 18? You know what I mean? And like, what if? Anyway.
Well, explain to people who TransLinear was. Like, what, you know, who were the members of the band? How did it come together?
Okay, so the first incarnation of TransLinear was me and Danny McGee. So it was just me and Danny. He was a drummer guy that I met in Guitar Lab. It was like a music class at South Lakes. He was like one of my first music buddies, and I was like, I already had like a 4-track recorder, and we started recording his drums, and I was doing overdubs on that. And then we called it TransLinear right away, but it was actually just a duo, you know, where I was playing bass and kind of singing, and I think we had like, you know, maybe 2.5 songs or something at some point. And then,
where did the name TransLinear come from?
I think it was just one of those like look in the dictionary kind of thing.
Hmm.
Because.
Okay.
The whole concept of the trip behind TransLinear was that I wanted to make music that was like anti-dance music. It was like music that you cannot dance to. That was kind of my whole idea. And so TransLinear, the definition of TransLinear means an abrupt leap from one thing to another. And that's exactly, that describes, you know, the music of TransLinear. We've got like, you know, we had songs where there was like 24 parts in one song where nothing would repeat. You know, it was pretty, you know, abstract. I mean, it was pretty, pretty crazy material. I mean,
Danny must have been a heck of a drummer.
Yeah, no, he was amazing. Yeah, and he was super into it because we were into like progressive, you know, we were into progressive bands like old, you know, like Rush and Yes and stuff like that, but I was also into, you know, Metallica and like a lot of hardcore bands like DRI and, Beyond Possession was like one of my favorite bands back then.
Now, were you playing the bass for the whole time also in all the recordings? Because the bass stands out to me as having, you know, for being anti-dance music, of being pretty funky bass.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like in the area, in Northern Virginia, the bass is overlooked as how important it was to the sound of Northern Virginia.
Man, that is so true, man. That's very well put. Very well put. I mean, and what happened is, and I think it has to do with maybe possibly like the go-go music scene from DC, and there's something definitely, there's something in terms of funkiness that was in the music in the DC area there for sure.
Yeah, even for really hard, really hardcore stuff would always have a certain like, and you know, I don't know, just bounce to the bass. It's not leaden like a lot of, you know, hardcore bands could be.
It's true. It would be like throughout, no matter what kind of music you played, there'd be some kind of ingrained kind of funkiness, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean that's part of what I love about Transilience.
Okay, cool. Well, and speaking of which, the genius bass player in Transilience is Andy Johnson. And the reason why what happened is, I remember I went to we used to have these shows in people's basements, right? And one time I saw, the first time I met Andy was he was playing bass with this band Doubt, which I later joined, actually. But that's another good thing.
Another classic Reston band.
Yeah. So, and what happened? So when I saw Doubt, I was like, I think they were actually called. It was with Ananda on I think playing guitar and singing, and I think they were called Ideas of Youth. I think they were called Ideas of Youth back then, before they changed the Doubt. Anyway. Oh, God. What happened? Okay, so I saw Andy playing the bass, and I was like, oh, my God, this guy is ripping apart the bass like I've never seen in my life. I was like, I have to get this guy in Transilience. Because I was like, he might actually be able to play all the fucked up timings and weird melodies and shit that were going on in my head, that I was kind of coming up with. He might be actually, because, you know, there's definitely a certain amount of musicianship that, or skills that you need to kind of, which I've lost in terms of dexterity on guitar, but, you know, that's kind of the shit I was into back then, super technical shit, and I was like, this guy could actually play, you know, he could probably come up with some ideas too, and we could, you know, he'd be a perfect match. So, because actually what blew me away about the way he plays is that he's the only bass player I know to this day that was playing the bass with his fingernails. So not only was he playing picking the bass with his fingernails, so he's got really strong, you know, fingernails on his index finger and, you know, what's the other finger called? Anyway. And he was, like, playing super fast lines, like, with his fingernails.
And that's crazy.
This guy,
I never heard of that.
This guy is too good to be just playing. He could be playing, whatever, right? So,
right.
Then, so I asked him, I was like, dude, you know what's funny? I actually asked him. He recalls the story. We talked about this, I don't know, whatever. Again, the story about me meeting him. And I walked up to him, and I think the first thing I ever said to him is, I said, hey, man, can you play complicated time signatures? He's like, of course I can. It was funny at the time because I think he hadn't really, he was just, his whole vibe was like, I can do anything. I can play any kind of, you know, I can play any kind of music or something. And I just thought that was pretty cool, his sort of bravado and just his confidence, you know, because I think later we talked about it and he didn't really know what I meant. I think he didn't know that I'm, like, he just thought, oh, I can play any time signature, you know, or. But then when we started getting into, like, writing the material for Transilience and then talk, because he was more into, like, stuff like Adolescence, and he wasn't really into the kind of tech metal kind of shit I was into.
Yeah. If you're like, what is 9? What's playing in 13?
Yeah, yeah. So, but he's such a great musician that he actually got into it, and then we really kind of made Transilience into a real band. And originally, actually, so on the first Transilience demo, which is called Strength and Fears, which came out in 1988. It's Andy on bass, me on guitar and singing, and my brother, Ruben, is playing the drums. My brother was visiting over the summer, what was funny is that he bought a drum kit so that we could make this recording. He isn't even really a drummer, but he's a really good musician. So we just rehearsed these like three songs, and then we made that first demo, you know, or four songs, I guess.
Seed Brothers, man.
What's that?
I said Seed Brothers. Yeah, Brothers in Restin.
Exactly. Once again. So, and then when he, you know, so after the recording, he had to go back to college. And then I don't know why Danny didn't keep playing with me. I can't remember what happened. I think we were looking for someone who was more serious. And I think maybe the vibe that Andy and I got from Danny was that he was kind of just maybe wasn't that interested in, you know, actually playing shows and all that kind of thing, you know. I don't really remember. But the fact is, you know, we were looking for a new drummer, which wasn't easy. But then what happened is I saw Dreadnought play in Maryland, I think. I think it was at the Paragon. I don't know if that still exists, but and Jamie Gugino, who ended up being the drummer in Transatlantic, he like completely blew my mind. I'd never seen a drummer play like that before, and I was like, I'm gonna ask this guy to put a few on.
You're just breaking up bands left and right. You knew what you wanted.
No, you know what it was. I just wanted to be surrounded by like sick ass musicians. That's all.
Yeah.
That would inspire me, you know. Basically. And you know, and I think it works. You know, it goes both ways. I mean, you know, what happened is because I gave Jamie the demo, and he wanted to play with us. You know, it's like so, and that's how we started, and that's when we started working on, you know, the debut album, which, you know, only it came out on cassette back in the day, but that's
and what album is that?
That's a mouthful of buildings.
See, that's the one I know, and that's the one I have on CD.
Okay, good. Yeah, because I mean, you know what? I gotta be honest.
Is it possible to get the original demo? Even
is that
out anywhere?
Well, there's actually two. Okay, so there's three cassettes prior to that album. There's Threat and Fears, which came out in 1988. Then my buddy Josh Krasnogorn was also in my guitar lab class. He made we had a recording. I don't know if he was recording it or we made an initial recording with Danny McGee and me. Anyway, he has some recordings that I don't actually have. But he sent me something recently, and I was like, whoa, I couldn't believe that there's like earlier recordings. So there's that early, very first recording. Then there's Threat and Fears. And then after Threat and Fears, we came out with Second Try, or is that, wait, what was it called? Anyway, there was a second demo. But we didn't get jackets printed for it or anything. Anyway.
Where did you record all this stuff?
Well, the first two, the first demo, the first real demo was recorded at the Inner Ear Studios in D.C.
Which we've talked about a lot so far on this podcast.
Oh, okay, excellent.
So, but keep going. I want to. Everybody always wants to hear the experience of recording at Inner Ear because it's so iconic and so important to the sound of Northern Virginia.
I know. So it was actually, his name is Paul Kearney. I don't know why I'm saying that name. Maybe that's way off. But he was kind of an engineer that was working out of that studio. So we didn't have Don Zientara. He didn't record and mix our album, but his sort of his under producer, whatever you call it, recorded our demo. And it was kind of like the way we did it was we recorded the whole thing in like an afternoon, and then we did the next day I did a couple of overdubs, and then we mixed it. So we did the whole four song demo in a day and a half, basically. So
what do you think it was that made the sound of Inner Ear special?
I just think there's something about the sort of DIY spirit of, you know, like Discord Records and Inner Ear that where it's like it made you, like going to Inner Ear, it makes you feel cool. Like you thought, like, this is actually cool. Whereas I feel like, I don't know, other recording studios in those days would be really kind of uptight and stiff and, you know, like a bunch of suits walking around and, you know what I mean? I think Inner Ear was just kind of like this other, just, it was associated with like cool people, not like whack people. So,
yeah. And they must have treated you, you know, well, despite the fact that you were, you know, a pretty young teenager at the time.
I know. And, you know, it's so funny because I'm thinking about it because I'm thinking back on it. I'm thinking, I just remember, like, I was so excited about the whole thing. I remember, like, we had to take a lunch break or something. And I was just in my mind, I was like, I can't believe we're recording in a recording studio. That's all I kept thinking about. And then, it's hard to imagine that looking back, like how we even got to that stage at such a young age, you know?
But it's funny, several other, you know, bands that I've talked to, people that recorded there and have a similar story to what you're telling right now. And it just amazes me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know how I felt as a teenager growing up in Reston, and how it felt like we were treated in South Lakes in high school, and how adults tended to look at us.
Yeah.
You know, and the idea that you could walk into a recording studio and they would treat you like a real person, like a real artist.
I know.
That at 16, 17, 18 years old, that's amazing.
I know, and I think something like that will just, once you have that in your, you know, in your, I don't want to say resume, but, you know, once you have that kind of experience at such a young age, it's something that you can build confidence off of, you know, for the rest of your life anyway, because it's like, no one can really fuck with you. You can be like, look, I went into a recording studio when I was 15 years old and we recorded our first demo. What were you doing? It's like, it's just something that I'll always have in my life. You know what I mean? It's not going anywhere.
You know? Your friends back in Germany must have thought that was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, definitely. 100%, yeah.
So tell me a little bit about Jam for Man.
Okay, so Jam for Man, I feel like I'm not the right person to ask, man.
But you played it.
I know, but I feel like, you know, I have to say, maybe my weakest link for me, I think, when I was, I felt like, I know, I had a lot of respect for, like, let's say, Brian Stewart and I think also Pat Kennedy, who really kind of looked at the Reston scene, the South Lake scene, as like, you know, something that was like from the community, and it was actually inspiring to the kids, and, you know, and motivational and all this. Like, they saw a lot of positivity, and I feel like I didn't really have that imagination back then. I didn't really think of it in a bigger scope, I think, you know, and so from an organizational point, I was kind of not, I didn't really, I just kind of, oh, they're doing a thing and we're playing, that's great, you know, but I feel like I don't really know that much about Jam for Man, and I want you to tell me.
Well, I call this podcast Jams for Man,
right,
in honor of,
right,
that series of concerts, but it's more about, I mean, I love the social consciousness of it. I love how they kind of took what they got from Positive Force BC and applied that to Reston.
Yeah.
But to me, it really is more about the bands that played it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the talent pool, the amazing amount of teenagers, musicians from my town and from Northern Virginia that, you know, didn't necessarily know what they were doing at all, and started bands and put on a series of concerts that had some amazing bands. And, like, I barely remember even going to one or two Jam for Man. You know, my memories are very cloudy of Jam for Man myself. But when I listen back to the demos of all the bands that played there, I'm amazed. I'm like, all these bands played these shows and they're from Reston? That's crazy.
I know, it's insane. It's totally insane.
So that's more what Jam for Man was about to me. And so more what I want to know is, so, you know, what were the bands and the sets that you saw there, and what was impressive in terms of the other musicians that you saw? What were you impressed by? I mean, other than the, you know, the couple of musicians that you poached for your band. The hostile environment was one.
Yeah.
They were at least, I know that they were playing the first Jam for Man.
Yeah.
With the Veil.
Yes, and I think, I'm not sure if it was the first one or the second one, but there's one of them where Transilians played, and then I also played bass in Doubt at the same concert.
Nice.
And
was that at the community center?
Yeah, at the community center. And again, I think a lot of credit goes to Patty. I'm like 100% sure that without her, none of this would have happened.
I mean, she was a parent who took these kids seriously also and was like, what can I do to help make this happen?
Wow. That almost gave me just goosebumps on my back. And it did kind of, actually. I just got goosebumps when you said that.
Well, I mean, it's awesome. I wish more parents had done that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think of a lot of kids that we lost,
mm-hmm.
you know, to different things,
mm-hmm.
from that era, and just, you know, there could have been a lot more positivity if there were more parents that helped channel, you know, the creativity and help channel kids into things that they wanted to do that could have had a meaningful impact
mm-hmm.
on the community at large and just do something awesome like what they were doing there. And mm-hmm. I wish there had been more of that. You know, a friend of mine, Patty Hirsch, who's another parent who got involved, and she did it by writing a book,
mm-hmm.
sort of about my generation, the time that I was in high school. It's called The Tribe Apart. It's a great
mm-hmm.
it's a great book about resting kids. If you haven't read it, you really should. And it's basically about, you know, how teenagers can be a tribe apart and how they need, you know, they need parents, they need mentors, they need people to help guide them and to lend a hand, you know, kind of without judgment and to keep the lines of communication open, if nothing else.
Well, sure. And I mean, you know, it's also like, you know, that whole thing about like idle hands, you know. You know, I think when you're busy making music or, you know, it's like you're not going to be able to have that much time to do drugs and shit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I do know what you're saying. Although, you know, they can go hand in hand too. Let's not.
Oh, yeah. No, Well, especially when you're young, because you just have so much energy, you know, you can just do it all. You can be totally, you can like, I mean, you can just go, bounce back so quickly, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about your generation, but there was a lot of access to hallucinogens, you know, back then when I was in high school too.
Right. Well, I think that was such a major thing for me because in Germany, I wouldn't have been able to experience like psychedelic drugs the way I did in Virginia. In fact, not at all around that time in the late 80s. So, and, you know, I can't even tell you. And I mean, it's hard to put in words how much psychedelic, you know, drugs affected my songwriting and my artistry just for my entire life. You know, I mean, I think Transilience is like completely, it's my version of psychedelia. You know, it's like, I think there's different types of psychedelia, you know, Grateful Dead, or there's like, you know, trance, techno music and whatever. But I think Transilience is my psychedelia. This is my version of psychedelia. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is certainly a psychedelic album. I never got to see you guys play live as far as I know. But but in terms of the album that I have, it's like punk rock crossed with psychedelia, you know, or like it's like a hardcore psychedelic album. And you don't find those things crossing over very much. But that goes with, it seems like, your whole career and your whole aesthetic. It's really hard to label you. You know, it's really hard to find a genre for what your music is. Nor would I want to, you know?
Okay. Well, I'll take that as a compliment, for sure.
It is a compliment. It's a very high compliment.
Okay, cool.
Spooky, I love talking to you, and I actually want to kind of segue from that to, you know, your career and what you've done in music and sort of the rest of your life, where it went after high school and beyond Reston. Unfortunately, I have a 3-year-old that's waiting for me at home.
Sure.
and a babysitter that's waiting for me to come home so she can go. Is there any way that we can schedule a part two of this sometime this week? Maybe call you tomorrow, or we'll figure this out and continue this conversation.
No, I would love to, because it's actually I've been enjoying talking to you about this, because it's just all these memories are coming back as I'm speaking to you, and I think it's really healthy actually to it's good and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I I'm the one who appreciates it. I love hearing about this stuff and. You know, I've been following your career and following what you've been doing ever since Transilience also.
Okay.
So, it's really exciting to me, and I want to get into all of that, too.
Well, I'm so glad you were able to get in touch with me, and let's keep the discussion going.
Yeah, let's do it. We'll talk about, we'll schedule something else really soon.
Excellent. Okay.
All right, dude.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you. I'll talk to you soon, Spooky.
Talk soon. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.